Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The invasion of Iraq is over, and so is the global arms race that most Americans have known all their lives. The United States, by any standard measure, has won. It is today the unrivaled military heavyweight champ by a very long shot. Tonight on Point, we tote up the Colossus and ask what all that American firepower means for America and for the world. We begin in Baghdad tonight, where Christian Science Monitor correspondent Scott Peterson has been tracking an unsettling pattern of deadly U.S. military interactions with Iraqi crowds. Last night, U.S. troops opened fire at an anti-American demonstration in the city of Fallujah, 30 miles west of Baghdad. Earlier, I asked Scott Peterson to describe what happened in Fallujah.
Well, it's not clear what exactly happened in Fallujah. What we have are competing testimonies. We have the version from American soldiers who say that there was an anti-U.S. demonstration of a couple of hundred people that got out of hand. They said that they had been fired upon, that there were people with guns in the crowd who fired upon them, and that they had returned fire. In the process of returning fire, they were fairly certain that they had struck at least seven people with bullets. Iraqis say that 13 or maybe 15 Iraqis died in the shooting, and that 75 Iraqis were wounded. Now, the Iraqi version is slightly different. They say that there were no weapons in the crowd, and that the crowd was fired upon indiscriminately. They also say that many of the people who were in the crowd were students who were protesting the fact that the American troops had set up base at their school, and therefore they could not go back to school. But then again, the demonstration really took place and gathered most momentum at 10 p.m. in the evening, which seems fairly late for school children to be out demonstrating. So my understanding from people who've spent time on the ground there today that essentially we had certain Islamic clerical elements who were there. You had pro-Saddam loyalists, and at the same time, there also were students in the crowd.
But 7 or 13 or 15 dead, and we read 75 wounded, is a lot of carnage at the end of U.S. guns in a place where the United States wants to be leading a peaceful, a benevolent occupation. And this is the third incident of death and protest against Americans in just a handful of days. We read at the end of the day, perhaps the next morning, of American helicopters flying over the cemetery where the dead in Fallujah are being buried and the crowds chanting against the United States. This is not a pretty picture, Scott Peterson.
Well, no, that's right. It is not a pretty picture, and I think that these kind of things are inevitable and at the moment and really are a function of how people are perceiving the American presence here. I mean, they certainly have been pleased that Saddam Hussein is gone, but there also are some very strong, staunch, and violent supporters of Saddam Hussein and the former regime who I believe and in fact have spoken to some of the people who've been engaged in this, are trying to basically make Iraq ungovernable. What they're trying to do is cause the kind of incidents, precisely the kind of things that we've seen over the last few days that yield civilian casualties, and then which are often blamed on American forces, even if in some cases it's not American forces who are at fault. But in any event, those kind of provocations are occurring. They definitely are clouding Iraqis' views of the American forces here, and it's something that is likely only to get worse until American forces actually come back with something in their favor, which is either increased and better security or begin to really get a grip with the new interim government.
Scott Peterson, you quote Major General Glenn Webster saying, "We have found that there are people in this country who don't want it to be secure, who don't want the electricity on." In other words, who don't want Iraq to be governable. You say you yourself have heard firsthand evidence of that?
Well, I spoke to a captured Saddam Fedayeen about 10 days ago or so, and this was someone who was remarkable. He was captured, he was being held in a cell at a mosque in fact, had been captured by some clerics. And he had been on a mission along with two others of his colleagues. They were supposed to go into a very populated area in eastern Baghdad called Saddam City, which is a large Shiite slum area. And what their mission was, and this was a Shiite man, but what their mission was to go into this area, three of them, three separate locations, use guns and hand grenades, blast them off in the middle of the night in such a way that they would attract crowds. Then they were going to leave behind some kind of a transmission device which would alert Fedayeen mortar positions to fire on those exact locations where crowds had gathered. And the aim, the purpose of this was to basically blame the Americans for causing this kind of carnage, saying that either Americans had fired into crowds of civilians or this sort of thing. Now, what was fascinating for me in speaking with this person was that this person had not received orders to defend Baghdad. He had not received, you know, when the Americans were on their way, he did not receive orders to defend the regime when it still had a chance of surviving. But what was cynical about the orders that he received was that they were meant for a post-Saddam period during which this would simply work toward undermining the American presence, undermining the U.S. ability to govern or even allow Iraqis to govern, and basically continue to instill fear in the hearts of Iraqis.
Scott, this brings to mind images of the Israelis in southern Lebanon or in the West Bank, rocks being thrown, guns being fired. Reuters is quoting here an American officer saying, "How is a U.S. soldier to tell the difference between a rock and a grenade?" Do you hear directly from U.S. troops that they're afraid of getting mired down in a kind of cycle of incident like this, where they're attacked, they fire back, Iraqi civilians die, anger mounts?
Well, that kind of thing, we have seen it, like you say. I mean, that's been happening in Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories for a very long time. I saw this in Somalia, where we had Pakistani troops fired directly into Somali crowds, and it was the exact same scenario that we saw in Fallujah, where you had an angry crowd complaining about the soldiers, and all of a sudden gunshots are fired. There are about six or seven Somalis dead. And, of course, the Pakistanis say that people in the crowd fired on them first, and they fired back. But, of course, everyone in the crowd said, and there were journalists among them who said that they didn't see any weapons, nor did they hear them fired from the crowd. So it really is a question of kind of competing views of the world in this sense, and it really does serve to undermine the credibility of these forces, especially considering when the Americans came in, they had such a wave of support from Iraqis' euphoria, in fact, that Saddam Hussein was finally gone. But as the Israelis have found, this is in many respects the result of occupation, and things can go wrong. It only takes a few people to cause a huge amount of problem. And in these cases, like the Fedayeen that I mentioned earlier, it only takes a handful of these kind of people who are determined and know what they want to do to really help shape and turn public opinion. And these are the dangers that American troops are facing here now.
Scott Peterson, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Scott Peterson is correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. He spoke with me earlier from Baghdad. In the air, on the ground, at sea, and even in space, U.S. military technology and its sheer mass of weaponry add up to a force stronger than the world has ever known. Flush with Iraqi invasion, hawks in the Bush administration are not shy about threatening to wield that big stick again to shape the world. Critics say such an overwhelming force can breed a dangerous arrogance, global resentment, new nukes, and terrorism. What do you think? Does the mighty American arsenal buy us security or a kind of blindness? In the box-cutter age, how should military power figure into American strategy? Are you glad to have all that might or not? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Maryland is Greg Easterbrook, senior editor at the New Republic, visiting fellow at the Brookings Institute, and author of the forthcoming book, The Progress Paradox. He wrote American Power Moves Beyond the Super, an essay published in Sunday's New York Times. Good evening and welcome, Greg Easterbrook.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, thanks for being with us.
Sure.
Also with us in Hanover, New Hampshire tonight, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello, Greg, the only journalist in America who saved this country $4 billion. Wasn't that it, Greg?
Oh, something like that. I never got a commission, though, Jack.
You deserve it.
a lot of money flying around out there. Greg Easterbrook, you've sort of toted up the American military advantage in this recent essay. And I have to say, for all that we've heard about it and all that we've seen on display, to have it all laid out was still kind of eye-popping to me. You say that the extent of the America's military superiority has become almost impossible to overstate, that the arms race is essentially over, that no one else can compete for years to come. You say no other nation is likely to even try, that the U.S. is stronger than the Wehrmacht in 1940, stronger than the legions at the height of the Roman Empire, both in absolute terms and relative to other nations. Tote that up for us here, if you would. What are the basic elements of that towering superiority you described?
Oh, there's so much, but just to do the basics, Tom, consider that we sent 5 of our 9 supercarrier battle groups to the Persian Gulf region for the assault on Iraq. We have 9 of these astonishing naval armadas. No other nation in the world has even 1 supercarrier battle group.
So the United States owns the seas.
Oh, totally. If you think about how the naval arms race was the key to great power relations for almost 4 centuries, the naval arms race is completely over. There is no other navy in the world that even attempts to contest the United States.
In the skies, you say opponents now often do not even launch their aircraft.
No, in both the Bosnia Kosovo operation, the Serbian Air Force never left the ground. In this attack on Iraq, the Iraqi Air Force never left the ground. All other governments of the world know that their planes won't even be able to retract their wheels before they're blown to smithereens by American air power. So they don't try to contest us. We have more advanced fighters and bombers than all other nations of the world combined. We have 3 operational stealth aircraft, 2 completed development and awaiting production funds. No other nation in the world even has a stealth aircraft on the drawing board.
And when you say 3, you don't mean 3 airplanes. You mean 3 breeds.
3 types.
In space, you say the United States essentially owns the military deployment in space.
Yeah, we have more and better reconnaissance satellites than all other nations of the world combined. The Iraq operation relied heavily for the first time on space-relayed data. You will eventually hear the details of that. Space-relayed data is the most efficient kind and enabled individual platoon commanders basically to have very complete information about the location and deployment of their own and enemy forces, the sort of thing that's often denied to generals of other nations is available to our squad leaders, and space is the key to that.
And on the ground, you say 9,000 Abrams tanks, not necessarily the biggest number of foot soldiers, but is it a dominant ground force?
Well, China could contest us in the terms of large standing army, but not in terms of armor. The Abrams M1 tank is by far the best in the world, and we have 9,000 of them, more advanced tanks than all other nations of the world combined.
So Greg, I guess we could tote it up forever. As you lay it out here, there's just advantage after advantage. But the question becomes, what does this suggest? Is this a completely enviable position? Does it put the United States in a position to essentially dictate world events or at least to defend itself absolutely? Or what is the primary implication of such hyper-military power?
Well, certainly it does not guarantee that we will get our way in world affairs, as we're currently not getting our way with North Korea. North Korea is staring down the barrel of the most powerful military ever assembled and is not yielding. Force is just one of many elements of international relations, and experience has taught that military power can only solve military problems. It cannot solve political problems. So our enormous degree of force is no guarantee of getting our way. I think to have America be the only hyperpower is generally good for the world, especially if you look at arms spending statistics. The American defense budget keeps increasing, although the Cold War is over. It's just gone up another $40 billion this year. But global spending on arms is steadily declining.
Because the rest of the world doesn't even try to compete with the United States any longer. Jack Beatty, what do you see here in this military colossus? Is this a blessing? Is this a curse? Is it mixed?
Well, let's imagine how Al-Qaeda looks at it. And taking nothing away from this incredible technology in our troops, I can imagine they would be thinking, tanks, missiles, armies, divisions, lay it on. That's great. We're glad you're spending the money there. You're not spending it on protecting chemical and nuclear plants here. You're not spending it on securing the borders. Above all, you're not spending it on the Nunn-Lugar program, buy, or enough of it, to buy weapons of mass destruction where we know they exist, namely in the former Soviet Union. So keep spending, and we'll find other ways of getting at you. In other words, we have configured our forces, it seems to me, in relation to the threat we face today, rather like the French did in the 30s. In building their Maginot Line.
We're going to come back and look at the implications of the of America's overwhelming military strength, its strategic implications. You can join the conversation tonight. In the box cutter age, does the hyper-military keep America safe? Does having a giant military tempt Washington to use it, to see it as the solution to a hammer? Does everything look like a nail? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. From Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Fresh off the invasion of Iraq, we're looking tonight at America's overwhelming military and its strategic implications. You can join the conversation. Greg Easterbrook says the arms race is over. America has won. Do you agree, and do you feel better for it? Does overwhelming military power buy security, or just lead other nations to turn to nukes and terrorism? Where is military superdominance taking America, taking the world? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We are joined tonight by Greg Easterbrook, senior editor at The New Republic, by our own Jack Beatty, and now in the studio by Andrew Bacevich, director of the Center for International Relations at Boston University and author most recently of American Empire, The Realities and Consequences of U.S. Diplomacy, published by Harvard University Press. Good evening and welcome, Andrew Bacevich.
Well, thank you very much.
It's great to have you here. Andrew Bacevich, what Greg Easterbrook laid out to such effect in his Times essay is material that you know well. It's one thing to look at the mass, the volume, the technological superiority, the unmatched, unrivaled money that's poured into it. But what, to your mind, does it mean? Have we just seen in Iraq an example of the advantage of having this enormous military? And what are the larger implications of having, sustaining, wielding that huge threat, that huge power?
Well, I certainly agree with Greg Easterbrook's description of our military supremacy. But the thing I would note is that this is not news. This force that he described, the stealth fighters, the carrier battle groups, the Abrams tanks, all that was clearly put on display back in 1991 in Operation Desert Storm. Mm-hmm. Supremacy is what we inherited from the Cold War. And so it seems to me one thing we might want to reflect on is what did we get in that first decade of American supremacy? Was the 1990s a decade of peace and harmony around the world? The answer is no. The 1990s is a decade of ethnic cleansing. It's the decade of genocide in Rwanda. It's the decade of American defeat in Somalia. It's the decade, if we go into the Bush era, it's the decade of catastrophic surprise on 9/11. So, A, it's not new. B, it doesn't seem to me that this is necessarily a panacea.
You know, I guess it may take something like what just happened in Iraq to bring into focus the scale of this military. Agreed. We saw 1991 and since the Soviet Union went down, American military might has not been matched. But somehow, to the country, I think this is just this brought
is
a, it home.
This is another. We're a people with a short attention span, mm-hmm. and so yes, this is a reminder of this reality, which again has been a reality for some period of time. It seems to me that, and I guess maybe it was Greg made this point earlier, the real issue is one of political purpose. Military power really is meaningless outside of a political context. We as a people, our political leaders, regardless of party, have now gone beyond thinking about military power as designed to defend America. We got much bigger aims. It is to project power. It is to project power to reshape the international environment. And it's not clear to me that even the sort of conventional military supremacy that we have, and it is impressive and imposing, is still going to suffice to allow us to reshape the world in accordance with our own values. I must say that The report at the top of the hour about that incident at Fallujah sort of makes the point. The best disciplined, best trained, best equipped, soldiers in the entire world, perhaps in history, find themselves involved in an immensely ugly incident that I think probably constitutes a major setback for our hopes of, quote-unquote, liberating Iraq.
10 o'clock at night somewhere on a street in Fallujah with a lot of angry Iraqi civilians and maybe a few gun-toting folks among them, and pretty soon you've got a lot of dead Iraqis, including dead children, this from a mighty military. But as you say, it's reduced to what's at that street level. But I guess the other thing that brings this military profile so starkly to mind right now is this power projection policy that the Bush administration in particular seems to embrace and put front and center. But I hear you saying that as vast as this is, it may not be sufficient to the goals you're seeing put forward by this administration?
Precisely. I mean, it seems to, at this point, do we have the capability of overthrowing any non-nuclear equipped dictator in the entire world? You betcha. There's no question about it. Does it follow that we have the capability to bring liberal democracy to all these places, which is the stated strategic aim of the Bush administration? I'm not sure. Again, lots of military power. Lots of military power may actually encourage you to define political objectives that are beyond your capability as a nation and as a people.
Greg Easterbrook, how about it? Andrew Bacevich looks out at all these numbers, at this towering power that you've described in detail, and says, in some degree, so what? It doesn't matter until you have political purpose tied to it, and the political purpose that's being tied to it may not be achievable by military power.
Well, I think that's right, but the fact that you possess power first does not guarantee that you will use it wisely. Power can be used unwisely, and history will judge whether the assault on Iraq was a wise use of power or not. We said earlier in the show that military power can only solve military problems. Certainly, it can't solve political ones. Whether the question, Andrew, touches on the question of whether having a high degree of power lessens conflict in the world. Actually, I would submit that the evidence is that it does. I'm sitting here looking at the report of the Center for International Development and Conflict Management of the University of Maryland, their report from last year saying, quote, the number and magnitude of armed conflicts within and among states lessened since the early 1990s by nearly half. Now, that report was written before the Iraq War, but terrible things did happen in the 90s in Somalia and in Rwanda. But the total amount of fighting in the world declined during that period. And I wouldn't say that American power was the main cause, but it was certainly a factor in it. The end of the Cold War ended proxy wars between the United States and the former Soviet Union, for example. And if you feel, as most people do, that what happened in Rwanda was a horror, then why didn't the United States military go in there guns blazing, which was the alternative? It's the only thing we could have done that we didn't do.
So you're challenging the idea that the 90s, when the U.S. military essentially stood alone, was a decade of descent into military problems, that you're seeing that military as a stabilizing force during that decade.
Oh, anyone would have to agree that lots of bad things happened in international affairs in the 1990s, and Somalia was a disaster for us. Rwanda was a disaster for the entire world. But I'm just on a factual basis quoting the Center for International Development and Conflict Management at U of Maryland, that the total number of both official declared wars and armed regional conflicts and the total number of casualties, both military and civilian, declined by about half in the 1990s. That would seem to me, that doesn't prove that American power caused it, but that would seem to me to be an encouraging statistic.
Andrew Bacevich, do you buy that assessment? How much of it do you attribute to American power? Can we look forward to an era of fewer military conflicts when we've got this giant global COP?
I'm not looking at the same report. I'm sure the report says what Greg says it says. I'm just hearkening back to the 1990s, and it didn't seem to me that as we watched the 1990s unfold, we had any sense that a new
of a peaceful era garden
of,
here.
Of peace had dawned. But what's the future look like? Well, we're all speculating about that. My own concern is that, again, back to political purpose, it matters the way we use our power. It matters the sort of purposes. It matters whether or not you know, we're killing innocent civilians in these ugly incidents when I don't pretend to judge.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm struck by the extent to which in the 1990s, many of our allies did not compete, did not challenge this American military supremacy, because in the 1990s, I think they judged that American supremacy to be in their interest as well as our interest.
And now
one wonders whether or not there's a reevaluation of that. Again, the Bush administration's reaction to 9/11, promulgating a doctrine of preventive war, is something that concerns me, and I think concerns a lot of other people. And so we may find more backlash. We may find resistance to this determination to use power to bring about political change and adherence to our norms. We may find that the arms race is not permanently over. There are groups of countries that have sufficient wealth and have sufficient technology, if they had sufficient will, that's the question, to mount a challenge to the United States. Not mount a challenge tomorrow, probably not mount a challenge in the next 5 years, but definitely to mount a challenge in the next 10 or 20 years. Well, whether they will do that in part will stem from whether or not they continue to believe that a world governed by one superpower suits their interests.
Jack Beattie, I guess this military commands our eye right now again because of what has happened in Iraq and because of this administration's stated new strategic approach to the world. You know, as Andrew Bacevich points out, it's prepared to go to preventive war. You call it a Maginot Line, but it's a Maginot Line that reached out and took Saddam Hussein right out of power. It's hardly static.
Well, I guess that depends upon what sort of threat you think he posed to us. If you think he had weapons of mass destruction, if you think he was an imminent threat, then I suppose that was a good use of power. But that remains to be seen. What we do know is that a group of stateless terrorists with a network all over the world that feed on the resentment of people of Western power have an in for us and are coming after us. And we know that we are not prepared to meet them here. I wonder if you put it to the American people, just as a sensible proposition, would you rather have, you know, another fleet of stealth bombers, or would you rather have every container that comes into the U.S. ports inspected? Would you rather have, you know, more M1 Abrams tanks? Or, as I said earlier, would you rather buy up with the $20-30 billion, the residue of nuclear, biological, and chemical weapons that are right there in the former Soviet Union today and available to somebody practically for the highest bidder? And I think people, the Americans, might begin to see that the Bush administration has really made a kind of strategic mistake here. The emphasis when Bush was at and with the Texas Rangers, his big insistence was on offense. You know, well, they had a terrible pitching staff. They were very bad on defense. And he's done the same thing here. It's all offense. But it's not cowing the terrorists. You can't use an M1 A1 tank, whatever it is, against you know, somebody's hatred of the United States. The shells won't penetrate. But so I just wonder whether the Bush administration has just made a fundamental strategic mistakes in its allocation of resources and in its strategy.
Andrew Bacevich, what do you make of the Bush administration's calculation?
Well, I mean, there's the question of, you know, would Americans want to have containers inspected or another stealth bomber? I think the answer is Americans want both. I mean, this military supremacy has not been foisted upon us. But frankly, we like it as a people. It doesn't trouble us at all, and I think we intend to keep it. But as a historical analogy, I think the analogy that works better for me is not with the Maginot Line, but is with the Arab-Israeli conflict. I mean, since 1967, Israeli military superiority vis-a-vis its Arab adversaries has been enormous. Mm. That hasn't resulted in Israeli security. It hasn't given Israel the peace that it deserves. And so...
And only tonight another big bomb has gone off in Tel Aviv.
And so that's not an argument to give up military strength. I'm not in favor of giving up military strength. The argument is that doesn't solve the puzzle. You have to look at politics.
But what about Jack's notion here of the Bush administration leaning toward offense? That is, have the big stick, go out and use it, but pouring less into security at home. There are still vulnerabilities. They're widely pointed out here at the United States. Would we be better off taking $50 billion, $100 billion out of that $400 billion and putting it right into the U.S.?
Again, I really don't think it's necessarily an either-or. Even though we are spending, we do spend as much on defense as the rest of the world put together, we're still only spending somewhere in the order of about 3.5% of our GDP, which is less than we routinely spent in the Cold War. So we could spend more
we
on
could,
security.
We could, but you say it's not either or, but we're not really doing all that might be done from the reports we read on the home front. So
we ought
it is
to do
still
more.
A choice, isn't
but,
it?
But the issue, I mean, the concern here is the manner in which we use this conventional military power. I think the Bush administration's manner invites a backlash. It encourages resentment and probably complicates our overall security situation.
We're talking tonight about America's overwhelming military and its strategic implications. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Ed's calling. Hi, Ed. You're on the line.
Thank you. As an American, I'm happy to weigh in on this decision. I'm concerned that essentially our use of the military is not a good application of force in trying to fight stateless enemies because it's somewhat akin to a deer hunter using an AK-47. It gets the job done, but it's brutal, and that brutality, I fear, is really going to lead to a very poor world opinion of our country, which will have repercussions for decades to come.
So you're saying go out in a more surgical way, in a more police style rather than military style after the terrorist threat?
Well, fight fire with fire, absolutely. It seems to have been our military approach in the past to fight military might with military might, and ultimately led to the standoff of the Cold War ending our opposition, our military opponents around the world. I think a similar approach may work using the very methods of terrorists, not necessarily terrorism itself, but intelligence, well-designed plans, and I think that may be a better approach.
Got it. Ed, thanks for your call. Greg Easterbrook, what do you think? Does the Bush administration look at this amazing military instrument and say this is our tool to fight terrorism or not?
Well, I think in the assault on Iraq, there was certainly a psychological motive as well as a strategic one. The United States had just been attacked. We had been harmed by someone else in the world, and there was a motive to strike back and essentially say to the rest of the world, don't you dare mess with us because this is what will happen to you. And probably to the extent that Iraq was motivated by 9/11, this lesson will be heard very loudly to the other governments of the world. We'll take it very seriously.
Does it filter through to deal with stateless terrorists?
That's the question, and there is some historical precedent that it does. I would point your mind back to the Pancho Villa terrorist raids into the United States before World War I, several of which were very grisly, women and children killed in
over the border from Mexico.
Yes, and we sent a military expedition, the famous Pershing punitive expedition, after Pancho Villa. Never caught him, just like we've never caught Osama bin Laden, but smashed up his organization and changed the psychology of that particular strain of terrorism. Prior to the Pershing expedition, young Mexican men had thought it was something of a lark to join Pancho Villa's organization. Afterward, no one would.
It didn't look so fun anymore. Greg Easterbrook, stand by. Andrew Bacevich, Jack Beatty. We're talking tonight about America's overwhelming military and its strategic implications. How does a mega military deter stateless terrorists? Were you impressed with the whiz-bang technology of the war in Iraq? Where is military super dominance taking America? Where is it taking the world? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about America's overwhelming military and what we're going to do with it, what it's going to do to us. You can join the conversation in the box cutter age. Does the hyper-military keep America safe? Does overwhelming military power buy security or just lead other nations to turn to nukes and terrorism? Where is military superdominance taking America? Where is it taking the world? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. My guest tonight in the studio, Andrew Bacevich, author of the new book, American Empire, The Realities and Consequences of U.S. Diplomacy. And from Maryland tonight, Greg Easterbrook, senior editor at The New Republic and author of the forthcoming The Progress Paradox. And right now we're joined by Paul from Newport, Rhode Island. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for being able to call.
Good to have you.
Part of the point I wanted to make has already been made, but I'd like to put forth a hypothesis that the Bush administration, in its manner of international policy, appears to the rest of the world to be motivated in self-interest. You look at Kyoto Global Warming Agreement, things like this.
That Washington did not join.
Right. And then you look at the manner of our public policy, calling Europe old Europe, dismissing the UN, you know, the overwhelming majority of countries that didn't want war, just dismissing the UN as irrelevant. From the outside, the U.S. just might start looking like not the kind of country that can be trusted as the one global superpower. And could this perhaps lead to the old Europe getting together and forming a kind of a counterweight to the United States military power?
Mm-hmm.
And we've even seen the rumblings of that this week. I wonder if your guests could comment on that.
Great, Paul. Thanks for your call. Andrew Bacevich, how about it? You talked earlier about the political purpose that drives a military. I guess another thing that's turning heads is the way in which in the couple of years of this administration, Washington seems to have grown very quickly into a real comfort with this huge military. There's a kind of leftover modesty or restraint from the Cold War where often it could not be used. Now it seems to be, hey, let's go. Could this turn too much of the world against the United States?
It certainly could, but I would caution us against seeing this current administration as marking quite as radical a departure as we read about in the press.
You don't think this is so different from Brent Scowcroft, from the Clinton years where we would send in one cruise missile and on our way?
Well, I mean, let's think about Clinton's military record. I mean, the failed war in Somalia was Clinton's war. The intervention was ordered by Bush, but it was Clinton's failed war.
Well, I mean,
Clinton who intervened in Haiti. It was Clinton who intervened in Bosnia. Clinton who intervened in Kosovo. Clinton who repeatedly bombed Iraq, ineffectively, but repeatedly. It was Clinton who got America comfortable with the routine, albeit in his era, ineffective use of force. These guys came into office, eager to employ U.S. military power, convinced that they could do it more effectively, and then, of course, seizing upon 9/11 as the opportunity that they could exploit in order to do that. But, Paul's question was about old Europe banding together. The potential is there. It bears watching. I must say my own guess is that the French and the Germans are simply too comfortable with taking their security for granted or relying upon the United States to provide for it, and they'll probably not form that counterweight.
And not putting out the money. Greg Easterbrook, what's your view? Do you see a qualitative difference greater than what Andrew Bacevich describes in the way this administration holds the military in its hand, wields it? Is there not a kind of shifting of gears that we've seen that's fairly dramatic?
Well, you've seen a dramatic assault on Iraq, but that might have happened regardless of who won the presidency in this case. There's a theory propounded most prominently by Timothy Fuller, a political scientist at Colorado College, that says that all modern presidents, basically since Wilson, have become militaristic. Dwight Eisenhower is the only arguable alternative to that, that the shape of the American office of presidency, that its nature and America's nature in the world tends to turn whoever sits in that office into a proponent of the use of force. And it certainly even had that effect on Jimmy Carter, who was, although not pacifist isn't the right word to describe him, was certainly anti-military when he took office.
Though a former nuclear sub-commander. So.
Had a nuclear background, a military background himself, but his first 2 years of foreign policy were very modest and very anti-military and didn't end up that way. Basically, all modern occupants of the White House have wanted to flex muscle.
So you're seeing this Bush administration is right in line with that trend, with that arc?
Well, I would say it's just carrying on the tradition of presidents becoming muscle flexors, Bush more dramatically so. One could make an argument that the world is better off for American muscle flexing, especially in the post-war era. It's a long argument to make, but I would say that most nations that we have messed with are better off, and certainly our victory in the Cold War was a positive thing for the entire world. Now, you can also find things like Panama in 1989 that just make you want to put your head in your hands, but most American use of power has probably made the world a better place.
Dan's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Dan. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to add, I think it's an insightful point to speak about the needs for defense rather than offensive strategies. I want to add to that I think also what we need to do is to explore the root causes themselves that might result with a need to use any kind of military force. I'm happy and reassured to be a citizen of the militarily most powerful nation. At the same time, I think we're really neglectful of recognizing what our security is really about. There are enormous environmental stresses, inequalities, widespread destitution and disease and corrupt, abusive regimes across the world, which lead to mass refugee movements and enormous violence and instability, which is going to affect us.
A great big root system there. Dan, we're almost out of time, but we've got your point, and thank you for calling in with it. Andrew Bacevich, what about it? Does this kind of military supremacy drive out awareness or willingness to deal with issues at their root?
I think that, in fact, the caller may want to vote for Bush's reelection, because if you read the Bush National Security Strategy, which I think is preposterous, but nonetheless, the Bush's National Security Strategy commits the United States to support a wide range of basic human rights.
Are we doing it?
Seems to imagine that through the use of American military power, we can bring about political change that can address all these great human problems. I'm skeptical, but that's what this administration says it's all about.
Through American military power, they're again riding that tiger. Greg Easterbrook, can you see addressing root causes coming to pass on the back of a tank?
Well, if the motive in Iraq was truly idealism, if it was to destroy tyranny, the record of history shows that tyranny must be actively opposed. We can't just talk about how we don't like it. We have to fight it. It's made America free. It's made other parts of the world free. Can we best all the tyranny of the world? Of course not. But the historical trend is toward democracy. 25 years ago, only one-third of the world's nations held multi-party elections. Today, two-thirds do. Democracy is expanding almost everywhere. Tyranny is on the run. As long as we use our power wisely, and that, of course, is a big question mark, as long as we use our power wisely to use it in the quest of the defeat of tyranny, sounds to me like a historically valid motive.
Well, that's going to be the last word tonight. Greg Easterbrook, thanks for joining us.
Sure. Thank you, Tom.
Greg Easterbrook is senior editor at The New Republic, author of the forthcoming The Progress Paradox. And Andrew Bacevich, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Andrew Bacevich is director of the Center for International Relations at Boston University and author of American Empire, The Realities and Consequences of U.S. Diplomacy, just out from Harvard University Press. Jack Beatty, last word goes to you.
Well, Paul, down there in Newport, Rhode Island, was talking about other nations balancing against us. And we had a guest on our program, Robert Pape at the University of Chicago, who said, well, it may be hard for them to do it in military terms, but, boy, they're doing a lot of soft balancing, voting against us at the U.N., holding up things that we want. In that last go-round at the U.N., we couldn't get the country of Guinea, to do what we wanted. So, yeah, there's a lot of balancing going on even now. It's just not with military force.
Great big military stick. We'll watch and see how it's used. Jack, thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onepointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, a rebuke to American journalists from one of their own. The American media's coverage of the war in Iraq is coming under fire from journalists on both sides of the Atlantic. First, the BBC's Director General, Greg Dyke, said he was shocked while in the United States by how unquestioning the broadcast news media was during this war, unquote. Then NBC News correspondent Ashley Banfield, in a speech at Kansas State University, lambasted the cable news networks, including her own MSNBC, for only covering one side of the war. NBC News President Neil Shapiro has since scolded Banfield for her remarks, and an NBC spokesman said yesterday that Banfield didn't intend to demean the work of her colleagues, and she will choose her words more carefully in the future. Here are excerpts from Banfield's speech, beginning with the things she says you did not see in the 24/7 embedded coverage of the war in Iraq.
You didn't see where those bullets landed. You didn't see what happened when the mortar landed. A puff of smoke is not what a mortar looks like when it explodes, believe me. There are horrors that were completely left out of this war. So was this journalism or was this coverage? There is a grand difference between journalism and coverage. And getting access does not mean you're getting the story. It just means you're getting one more arm or leg of the story. And that's what we got. And it was a glorious, wonderful picture that had a lot of people watching and a lot of advertisers excited about cable news. But it wasn't journalism, because I'm not so sure that we in America are hesitant to do this again, to fight another war, because it looked like a glorious and courageous and so successful, terrific endeavor. And we got rid of a horrible leader. We got rid of a dictator. We got rid of a monster. But we didn't see what it took to do that. I can't tell you how bad the civilian casualties were. I saw a couple of pictures. I saw French television pictures. I saw a few things here and there. But to truly understand what war is all about, you've got to be on both sides. You've got to be a unilateral, someone who's able to cover from outside of both front lines, which, by the way, is the most dangerous way to cover a war, which is the way most of us covered Afghanistan. There were no front lines. They were all over the place. They were caves. They were mountains. They were cobble. They were everything. But we really don't know from this latest adventure from the American military what this thing looked like and why perhaps we should never do it again. When I said the war was over, I kind of mean that in the sense that cards are being pulled from this famous deck now of the 55 most wanted. And they're sort of falling out of the deck as quickly as the numbers are falling off the ratings chart for the cable news stations. We have plummeted into the basement in the last week. We went from millions of viewers to just a few hundred thousand in the course of a couple of days. Did our broadcasting change? Did we get boring? Did we all of a sudden lose our flair? No. I think you've just had enough. I think you've seen the story. You've seen how it ended. It ended pretty well in most Americans' view. It's time to move on. What's the next big story? And that makes our job very difficult, because we tend to leave behind these vacuums that are left uncovered. When was the last time you saw a story about Afghanistan? It's only been a year. And here we are not touching Afghanistan at all on cable news. And I'm very concerned that the same thing is about to happen with Iraq, because we're going to have another Gary Condit, and we're going to have another Chandra Levy, and we're going to have another John Bonet, and we're going to have another Elizabeth Smart. And here we are in Lacey Peterson. It's important that we continue to want to know what happens overseas when we leave. It's important to demand coverage of these things. It's important because your safety and your future and your world and your children will depend on this stuff.
Ashley Banfield is a correspondent for NBC News. She delivered her speech at Kansas State University. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded.